Congress found plenty of money for foreign countries, lobbyists, and special interests while sending the bare minimum to the American people who need it. It wasn't their fault. It was China's fault, not their fault. I am asking Congress to amend this bill and increase the ridiculously low $600 to $2,000 or $4,000 for a couple. I'm also asking Congress to immediately get rid of the wasteful and unnecessary items from this legislation and to send me a suitable bill, or else the next administration will have to deliver a COVID relief package, and maybe that administration will be me.
Where was that guy these past 4 years? That was President Donald Trump on December 22nd. It is now December 28th, so let's check in at Reason.com for the latest headline from Elizabeth Nolan Brown. Let's see. Trump gets none of his demands in the spending bill, but signs it into law anyway. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the last Reason Roundtable of our accursed year 2020, the lessons from which we're going to break down later in the program. I am Matt Welch, joined by my colleagues Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Hi, everybody.
Merry howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy holidays.
We are going to talk about the last great legislative spasm of the Trump presidency here in a moment. But first, two items, numero uno of which. Do you know our friends at the Institute for Justice? They sue governments for abusing power and violating individual rights. In addition, IJ has a great new podcast, newish podcast, called Deep Dive with the Institute for Justice, where you can hear stories about little guys and gals fighting Leviathan to secure their rights. You will hear firsthand from the attorneys and plaintiffs and learn valuable lessons along the way about the law and the Constitution, capital C. You can find a Deep Dive with the Institute for Justice wherever podcasts exist, as well as at the internet website address ij.org/deep-dive. Listen today. You'll be glad you did. Numero dos. Do you remember the good times that we all had together as a country when you sent us a bunch of questions and stuff for us to answer during our webathon here on the Reason Roundtable? Special webathon, special video webathon, bad haircut edition. We want to kind of make that a regular thing going forward. So please send your questions, whether individually or as a group, to the following email address, roundtable@reason.com. Not hard to remember. Tell us what name you prefer, what pronouns you prefer, if that's an important thing. Yeah, Twitter account address, handle, if you got one, we'd read it out loud. You can even send us an audio file if you want, not that we would do anything except hold it up for ridicule. We will start incorporating your questions just as soon as there's enough good ones. So send them along, roundtable@reason.com. Okay, on to the $900 billion relief package that Trump signed into law, although he did say something about he's going to redline some things. I don't know if what part of the Constitution says redlines. But anyways, we dived into the specifics of this last week, thanks to Peter Suderman. But Nick, since you are the Imagineer of the group, I would like you to kind of riff, muse, think on what would it have been like if we would have seen or heard or watched the antics of the December 22nd Trump, as opposed to the guy who just signed this thing into bill. Like, what opportunities were lost that a guy making some populist sense about the awfulness of a 5,000 and something page bill being signed had actually governed with that in mind?
Yeah, that we'd be in a very different place. I also think if the Donald Trump had showed up for the second of what turned out to be two presidential debates, had been around since January of 2020, he probably would have won the presidency. There is a version of Donald Trump where he tones down his bellicose rhetoric a little bit and substantively is very similar. And he's not a terrible president. We're on a string of terrible presidents, certainly in this 21st century. And Trump would have not necessarily been in the top two if he had governed the way that he talked in the clip that you were pointing to, Matt. But it's, you know, this is all folly, right? Because there are no redos in American history. We can learn from the past, but we can't really change it. And I think, you know, part of the problem, and I've talked with this about a lot of kind of Trump fans, and they almost to a person said that there's no way he could have changed anything he did because who he is why he got there. And, you know, it's this, it's a really shitty time travel movie, you know, where you finally go back in time and you're going to abort baby Hitler using Planned Parenthood Medicare funds or something. And then it, you know, it just turns out that Hitler finds a way, you know, so.
I think this is the plot of Tenet.
Well, you know, we'll leave that to, you know, future paleontologists to sift through that. Yeah, it points to a future, though, I think, that is actually or a possible outcome of, you know, thesis, antithesis, synthesis. What Trump is saying in a lot of these kind of outbursts is actually not bad. Like, and, you know, and just to put it a fine point on it and then shut up for a bit. Why not $2,000 per person, or why not direct all or virtually all of the aid that is going to America, to American people, as opposed to, you know, airlines and to foreign countries and to all sorts of things like that? This was one of the basic critiques, and I think it was a good one, that was put into play at Reason during the financial crisis, that a better stimulus or a better bailout would be to give it to people rather than to corporations or states and local governments that just, you know immediately the minute that you hand them the money, it's gone down the toilet and that they're going to be back with the other hand asking for more. I wish this Trump had shown up, but alas, Matt, it was not to be.
Suderman, you were a bit disdainful or skeptical about Trump's initial outburst as opposed to my more enthusiastic take. Explain a little bit about your reticence for celebrating his week-long delay of signing this package.
I think that the key here is to take his statement in context. So we listened to the end of it. It's about a four-minute statement. And if you listen to it in pieces, there are some ideas that I think, you know, you can say, oh, this is worthwhile. And in particular, I think the one completely unobjectionable point that he makes that I totally agree with, and I would like to see more politicians make, is that when he made this statement, Congress was on the verge of signing a 5,000-page, $2 trillion bill that absolutely none of them had read and that absolutely none of them could have read. And that is objectionable. That's bad. And Trump was right about that. But the rest of his statement was, let's cut what amounts to a very tiny amount of spending, perhaps a few billion dollars. Yes, a few billion dollars is a lot of money. But in the context of the federal budget, it's nothing. It's pocket change. It makes absolutely no difference. It's like your car is totaled and you're really worried about like whether the left front tire PSI is off by 2 points. Like, that's just not your problem at all. Maybe you should have been taking better care of your tires. But no, the problem with the car is that it's total. And so he's saying, let's cut a few billion dollars, and then saying, let's add something like $350 billion in additional spending. And he hadn't negotiated this. He had an opportunity to do so. And if that's what he really wanted, he could have stepped into the process and influenced it. So in some ways, this was just sort of a kind of a weird and tellingly weak use of the presidential bully power. But it's just like if what you want is less spending, smaller bills, if you want less reliance on stimulus, what Trump's main ask was to cut a very tiny amount of spending and replace it with a very large amount of spending. And then at the very end to say, and maybe I'm still president and going to still be president the next administration will be mine. It was like a clown coup. I mean, I don't know, right? Like, there's, again, I don't love this, you know, the idea that we're calling this a coup, except that what Trump is doing is repeatedly suggesting that he won an election that he didn't win. And he is at least gesturing rhetorically toward the idea of using presidential power to make that a reality. And in the process, he's doing this crazy stuff with legislation where his argument essentially is this bill should have been much bigger and spent much, much, much more money. And that was the real problem with it.
Which, in fairness, is how Trump has treated what few kind of budgetary impasses that and government shutdowns that he's had. It's all over.
And that's, he wanted more money, that has been his consistent approach, right? And so I just, you know, Nick says that there's a lot, you know, that it's not at, that what Trump was saying isn't really all that bad. And again, I agree. If you take little tiny bits out of context, you can find things that are not all that bad. Yeah, but I think in context, maybe I'll be president after we do the transition of power. And also we should spend a ton more money is bad.
Catherine, Nick led with baby Hitler. Suderman went with the clown coup. So just, you know, as you answer the following question, I want to keep that in the back of your mind, just as on a one-upsmanship
right in the front, Matt, thing. Just right there.
So does this this kind of process of the bill itself, the Trump theatrics, whatever, the lack of reading it, does this all just prove that Justin Amash is right, even though he won't return my phone calls?
Everything proves that Justin Amash is right, especially that he won't return your phone calls. And
yeah, suddenly I'm behind him 1,000%.
1,000%.
Have you tried slacking him?
So basically, yes. Like I actually think, you know, Nick and Peter have just done a lovely encapsulation of what the entire Trump presidency has been like, which is, you know, it's like that illusion where it's an old lady and then it's a duck and then it's an old lady and then it's a duck. Like Donald Trump is the old lady
playing
duck.
Golf, right?
It's a fat guy playing golf on a course that he lives with, faces looking at each other. Because those comments...
There's no way it's a duck.
It's an old lady and a duck. Those comments were both a very nice list. And the part before the clip that we played was him just doing like a very classic citizens against government waste style list of all the dumb stuff that was in this big spending bill, just a huge list. And it sounded good to me. It sounded right. I was like, yeah, we should definitely spend less money on dumb stuff. But it was also at the same time, while you were listening to these words that were sort of the right words, it was also enumerate in the way that Peter has pointed out, like the numbers don't add up. You can't just say, and whatever it should, the spending should zero out, which is what Trump has said. But we're only going to cut like government aid to Burma. It was xenophobic. You know, it was like in between the two sentences that were like, it is not individual people's fault that they cannot make a living. Yes, preach. It's China's fault. What? No.
First of all, there's no red in front of China. So yeah, it's already so grammatically incorrect.
And then, of course, there was the anti-democratic kicker, as Suderman noted. But this is how the conversation about Trump is always going to go after he is out of office. It's there because he speaks unclearly and because he is boldly unafraid of internal contradiction and because he mostly just talked and didn't do a lot of things. We can debate forever whether he is an old lady or a duck. He's both.
All right. That's a fine threefer there. So let's
Matt,
just
do you
go
wanna,
straight.
Do you want to add something that either relates to Prague or the Beach Boys, perhaps just to tie this up in a little bow?
I would go with McCartney 3,
okay.
The release, which is a return to form, Nick. It really is.
Yeah, that's part of the problem, Matt, I think.
No, let's go. Let's move on. This is the last roundtable that we're doing in the calendar year 2020. And so I wanted to go across and chew on a little bit the various lessons that we have learned in what has been a pretty awful year in a century that hasn't been delivering a whole lot for us so far, except for dystopian young adult fiction.
Nick, by the way, has been canceled.
Young adult Twitter has
eaten its own problem.
Divergent is one thing, but yeah.
So I want to talk about one big lesson that each of us has learned from this. And Nick, I'll start with you, but with the limiting principle of you cannot reference psychedelics or baby Hitler unless you combine them. Go.
You know, for me, the big lesson was that the noble lie is alive and well and living in our power structure. And I'm thinking particularly of somebody like Anthony Fauci, but it's not the only thing. But where, you know, Fauci famously, as, you know, the most visible person on Trump's coronavirus task force, went through a bunch of things about being against lockdowns, being for lockdowns, against regular people using masks is doing that. Most recently, he, in a New York Times interview, talked about how he's now upping his estimate of what is necessary for herd immunity because people are finally able to hear his message, or they'll be receptive to it. And I think, to me, one of the lessons of 2020, which of course builds on, you know, literally decades, at least a half a century of activity by people in power, typically in government power and political power, but also this extends to many people in corporate power as well as kind of cultural power, places like the Catholic Church, charities like the United Way, where they just lie in the name of, you know, some greater good. And that has been revealed and rubbed in our face, I think, with COVID-19, with the pandemic, and the way that people who did not know for sure what they were talking about went ahead as if they did. And that's bad. I guess that might be misinformation. And they're not explaining to people that their pretense to knowledge is a lot shakier than it is. And let's figure this out in a deliberative way with the participation of everybody in society. That's what a democratic society is supposed to be. That is what a market-driven society is supposed to be. That is what a libertarian society is supposed to be. And they just bulldoze ahead as if they know what they're talking about without any reservation. That's kind of disinformation. Then there's misinformation, which is also complicated but related. And I think that's what one of the other great lessons of 2020 is, simply that it's not simply that governments lie or that, you know, people in power lie when it suits them and it suits their agenda. And we may not know for a long time what agenda they were pursuing, but that at best we don't have as good a grasp of what's going on in the world as possible. And that can easily lead to nihilism. But it shouldn't, and it doesn't have to, but we need to become more, you know, we need to be willing to live in, you know, in half shadows and be able to acknowledge that we don't know as much as we know and that we still have to make choices and move forward. And to me, that's, you know, I think what was rubbed in our face throughout the pandemic and will continue to be, because this is something that goes back to, you know, depending on what generation you want to lay claim to, it can be, you know, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. It can be, you know, the way that the Cuban Missile Crisis was resolved, whatever. I mean, there's just like big fat lies that have undergirded major, major changes in how America, you know, what America and the world looks like. But in any case, if we could start actually acknowledging that governments lie, that they should not be allowed to lie to their people, and also that even when people are trying to do the right thing, their information is often bad or incomplete and subject to radical revision. Those would be great lessons, I think, for us to take out of 2020.
Before I let Catherine sprinkle a little bit more acid in the direction of Dr. Fauci, I just would point out something I've probably mentioned a time or two before, which is that the Centers for Disease Control's own guidelines about pandemics include way up top, like, be honest in the way that you talk to the public, including what you don't know. And that way you will build up credibility, which will make your warnings about do this or don't do that have a lot more power. And I think it's amazing to me to see people who are absolutely familiar with that, including Fauci, dismiss it. And then to see other politicians just that's where we get the do as I say, not as I do type of policies everywhere in the country. People didn't take that seriously. And now here we are 9 months later in some places. You know, the epidemic is much worse than it's ever been. As terrible. Catherine, you want to be mad at Dr. Fauci?
I do.
Should we be calling him doctor, by the way? I mean, he is a medical doctor, I guess, but he's, you know.
The medical doctors, when talking about them in their role, okay. Like Dr. Jeff Singer, a dear friend of this podcast, we can call them doctors then, Nick.
Thank you. Dr. Gillespie. Thank you for the clarification, Matt Welch.
Though I do want to note that Reason style, like our house style, is to not use honorifics at all because of this very problem. So we can just call him Fauci on second mention. No, he, you know,
the,
he...
The Fauci.
The Fauci, if you prefer. Yeah.
The Fauci.
He's been brought up in the kind of public view as a hero of this epidemic in many ways. In my neighborhood, when you walk around, there are little signs that say, thank you, Dr. Fauci, maybe because he lives in my neighborhood. I'm not sure. And
that's got to be a QAnon. I mean, I think that's where the pedophiles are meeting then.
No, there's a guy. The guy with the pedophile sign is outside of the Naval Observatory in front of the Vatican.
Still there? Yeah,
the Vatican building. So he's actually haven't seen him in a long time. I hope he's okay. But Fauci is. You know, this weekend he's chatting with BBC Radio and just casually noting that a big problem with our pandemic response was that states have autonomy from the federal government. And I, you know, there are better and worse versions of this argument. And if what he is saying, if what someone was saying was to say, hey, you know what would have been better? Like a little coordination, just like a little communication and coordination among authorities, that might have made this whole thing a lot smoother. Sure. If you're saying like, hey, you know what would be great? Like some kind of federal bureaucracy, heck, maybe a couple of federal bureaucracies specifically empowered to manage public health crises. Like that's a great idea. We should have those. Oh, wait, we do. They did a terrible job, really genuinely terrible. And, you know, see Nick's previous remarks about noble lies. If you're saying the reason that this country failed to respond well to coronavirus is because of federalism, because we have power devolved to the states and thence to the people, I just don't buy that line. That simply isn't what went wrong. I can talk a little bit more about why I think that's true in my answer to 2020 lessons. So I don't know, Matt, if you want me to run away with my own segue.
Keep going.
Or if
Keep
I can
going.
Wait.
Keep
I'm
going.
A patient woman.
No, do it.
No, my segue is like I've been thinking a lot about the phrase personal responsibility. I feel like my big 2020 lesson is just like, what does that actually mean? And
doesn't it just mean privatize
it
Social
does.
Security?
That's what it means. It means it means privatize the Department of Defense. It means you're on your own, suckers. No, it doesn't mean that. And that actually is what I've been thinking about because, you know, I was reading last week about Iowa's response. And we also published an article in the last issue about Singapore's response. And so I guess what I want to talk about is what personal responsibility means in the context of culture. I think 2020 has been another lesson for me, a reminder for me that culture trumps policy in so many ways, that it is always that policymakers will always underestimate the power of culture in shaping people's decisions. And Iowa, for a really long time, had no coronavirus lockdowns, nothing like that, no mask mandates, nothing. Basically because, A, they had a Republican governor who was that kind of Republican, and B, because Iowans believe that Iowans are going to do the right thing. And Iowans often do, I think, except in the Iowa straw poll when they do the wrong thing consistently every 4 years. But
not in the Iowa Writers Workshop?
In the Iowa Writers Workshop is sort of 50-50 on that.
They just commit war crimes there. Go on.
And so I guess I just... You know, when we talk about personal responsibility, it means individuals, but it also means individuals operating in the context of both their policy incentives, as have been kind of given to them from above, but also the culture that they are a part of and that they create. And, in Singapore, people are very, very satisfied with an incredibly authoritarian government. They say they are fine with it. They routinely tell pollsters that they're fine with it in a way that, you know, you might be like, listen, they live under a very authoritarian government. Of course, they're going to tell pollsters what the pollsters want to hear. But which I think is real. Like Singapore is a different place than New York City, which is a different place than Iowa. And the idea there was somehow a right answer to handling COVID, either on the policy level or on the individual level, is deeply foolhardy. It is wrong. The flip side of this to me, though, is when you say, OK, our policy has to be loose to let localities or individuals make good decisions. Individuals should think hard about making good decisions and listen to the cultural norms around them. And that means put on your mask and be polite to other people around you if they are scared when your mask is off. It means stay at home. It means don't do the stuff that was going to make this worse for everyone. And I do think that that element of personal responsibility has been bandied about, but there has also been a subset of people who have talked long about the role of liberty and responsibility and how they work together, and then taken that to mean, screw you, I don't want to wear a mask. And I do think that's a misunderstanding of personal responsibility.
I just to build on that, make a couple of observations. One is that obviously Iowa is the site of the Czech and Slovak Museum.
Wow.
And there's a lot of Czechs who are derived in Iowa. And Czechs did not have masks early on in this crisis. So what did they do? They awesomely, everyone knit masks. The Czech Republic had the world's, like, outside of maybe Singapore, I don't know, but like basically they had more mask, like total mask compliance by like April. It was a wonderful, you know, heartwarming story.
Help them?
How'd that go for their death rates?
Low, and then in the fall, ba-ka-boom! Which is to say that I think that one of the, and this isn't my lesson, I'm just interjecting here, wasting time, is that everybody wants to moralize this. It's amazing. It's amazing how much we constantly want to point a finger at the reason why that person got it. Nick Gillespie got it because he's a moral reprobate who just takes mushrooms all day long.
Primary vector just got it, suggesting that he did not have it when he thought he gave it to me in late February. Mr. Rob Long, conservative commentator, Ricochet.
Right. Are you outing him on this podcast?
Yeah, no. We talked about it. I interviewed him earlier this year, and he had a cold. It was in late February, early March, something like that. And we had all assumed that he had been, you know, my patient zero, but apparently not. Matt.
Yes, I know. It could have been me getting it from Ross Douthat. Anyways, so...
So, Nick, would you say that the arc of your personal history is long?
And it bends toward benzodiazepines.
If we can go back in history and abort baby Suderman.
As long as it's with private funds, Matt, I don't really see a moral issue. It's a
no, Peter, I don't mean that. We want to assign morality, like public policy morality, constantly, constantly, constantly. We want it to be worse in Florida or worse in California, depending on how we feel about like restaurant mandates and whatever. And just like knock it off. It reminds me of, and this is going to be a strained analogy, perhaps. When I was a teenager, my face broke out. I got a total pizza face with acne, right? Back when there was acne in this world. And my poor dad, who I'm throwing under the bus here, said, well, you know, you got to lay off those chocolates. Yeah. And it's like, I've never eaten chocolates my entire life.
Foods.
Like, if you know me, I don't eat.
I love the image of teen Matt, like, playing guitar and just eating a box of, like, Russell Stovers or something, just breaking out.
Looking, stopping to look at the diagram because he wants to avoid the lemon cream.
Oh, no. The raspberry one is...
Teens get acne, and it's like that's one of the things, especially if their
Matt,
dads had it themselves.
It's because you were masturbating all the time. That's why you had acne. Well, your father was wrong in specific, but he was right that you deserved it because we're born with original sin, Matt Welch.
There's something weird about maybe all of humanity. I want to say maybe especially this country. I don't know. But like, stop it. It's a pandemic. Like, There's no particular rhyme or reason in people getting it or not getting it. That doesn't mean you shouldn't apply personal responsibility, but it does mean you should perhaps, with rare exceptions of people like, you know, tongue-kissing, you know, COVID patients, you should stop laying blame on everyone. Knock it off. All right, enough of that. Peter, I'm unaborting you in history and allowing you to talk. And what is your big lesson from here, aside from that Matt Welch should be aborted retroactively?
Acne-riddled Matt Welch.
Matt, I don't want to go back in history and do anything mean to you. I just want to like deliver some acne medication. It's great. It helps
I
the
had,
skin.
I
right?
had
like,
Stridex. I did Accutane twice. God.
You know, just some face washing lessons, good skincare. It's important. It's a thing you really learn in a pandemic.
Lay off the chocolates.
Also, my dad's
I'm
name
here
is Peter,
from
so,
the
so this is
future.
So speaking of learning lessons and like things that you can like figuring out things to do to improve your health and yourself and your society is like the thing that's that sort of stands out to me this year, is that humans are adaptable, like really adaptable, and that human society just sort of reorganizes itself on the fly to address problems in ways that you that until you see it happen, you wouldn't predict, you would think couldn't happen. If you had told this panel in January, certainly if you'd told me what the rest of this year was going to be like, I mean, it would have sounded bizarre and apocalyptic. And in a lot of ways, it was bizarre and apocalyptic, right? We have 333,000 people who have died from COVID. We have rolling lockdowns and travel bans, greater restrictions on personal and economic liberty across the world, especially in the United States, than I have seen in my lifetime, many of which would have been unthinkable a year ago and turned out to be not only thinkable, but we thought them and we did them. At the same time, people found ways to make it through, largely due to private sector innovations, to kind of private personal arrangements. And you think of everything from school pods to, you know, advances in grocery delivery to, you know, the boom in streaming services that that sort of kept people entertained and gave people stuff to do, to, you know, Zoom and Skype and all the different ways to like actually look at other people's faces, whether or not you wanted to, even if you weren't in the same room. And it was totally flawed, totally imperfect, and also really kind of impressive in many, many ways, not all, and not without, you know, not without, certainly it's not beyond criticism, but people figured out how to live. And I just think that if you'd sort of described a year like this to people last fall, most people would have been like, I don't know how anybody would make it through. And some people didn't. And it was really hard for a lot of people. And I do not mean to discount the suffering that we have seen this year. At the same time, the kind of the ability of individuals and organizations to figure out how to come up with workarounds, and even not just workarounds, but like new stable and durable solutions that can actually improve on the previous status quo is pretty impressive. And that's mostly, like I said, in the private sector, because I think the clearest points of failure were in the bureaucracy and in politics. And you just to name a couple of examples, some of which have already come up, the FDA, which just absolutely blew the test kit response and the sort of development of like our sort of... our national policy understanding of how to test for and look at and understand COVID as a disease early on, and just kept blowing it, I think, throughout the year. And teachers' unions, which are kind of a melding of bureaucratic and political concerns that just failed the people that they were supposed to be helping throughout the year, and failed in ways that I think are relatively predictable, but were especially noticeable and spectacular this year. But the private sector and individuals acting to try and figure out what's best for them, for their families, for their communities, for the people on their block, I mean, it was pretty impressive at all levels, right? Just down to the kind of to the household, from the household level, and the ways that people figured out how to cook different things and change the way they ate and change their personal schedules, to the giant corporate level, where we have multiple good vaccine candidates in basically the shortest time frame on record. And there is something, you know, frustrating about all of this, and something really irritating, if not sort of awful, about the government response. But there's also something really heartening about it, and something you can look at and say, wow, actually, in a lot of ways, not all, but in a lot of ways, people did kind of okay.
I will pick up a thread that Peter just laid down there for my lesson. He was talking about teachers' unions. My lesson is that power corrupts, and public sector union power corrupts public sector unionly, or really badly, or it's just amazing to watch how someone could squander what is essentially a guaranteed revenue stream. It's a point that Nick Gillespie and I make often in our book from 2011, The Declaration Ooh. Of Independence, How Libertarian Politics Can Fix What's Wrong with America.
Point people to the 2012 paperback edition with
that's true.
A foreword and updated material.
Yes, and a centerfold. So it's amazing to watch what happened, compare the United States what they did with reopening schools compared to literally the rest of the developed world, if we still use that. Our schools are predominantly closed. Theirs are predominantly open. And it is due to two overlapping factors. One is the aforementioned local provision of government goods, which still happens in this country, despite the way that most of politics feels like it's discussed and carried out. And that's also, you know, different than France, certainly, the way they carry out school policy. And the other one is that just that teachers unions, public sector unions, have way more power in the United States than they do most other places. As a result, teachers' unions have tried their hardest to make it possible for teachers to teach remotely and have steered all public policy in that direction. As a result of all of that, they are losing enrollment. It is amazing. 5%, 6%, something like that nationwide right now is the year over year decrease. Some of that's going to be like red shirted kindergartners, but others of it, it's true. Others are just not because the end result is that parents realize that schools are comparatively much safer places and anywhere where kids gather, because kids are not comparatively spreading, catching, suffering from the disease nearly as much as other sectors or other cohorts generationally. So people are leaving. And that's the thing. When people leave the school districts, like, you have a pretty guaranteed revenue stream in terms of, like, they're tied to property taxes in most places and so on. But a lot of the formula, or at least a major chunk in most places, is the number of students that you have in school. And so teachers unions, by protecting their teachers and having a semi-guaranteed revenue stream, repelled students. Because they're not providing an education. Remote education sucks. It's really bad. And people don't want it. And people want to have some kind of a sense of predictability. You know, even in a place where the schools are supposedly open 5 days a week, as in where I live in New York, my five-year-old has been to school three times since they reopened schools. That doesn't make any sense at all. There's no predictability. And so as a result, they're going to have to fire teachers all around. Even with a, you know, a teachers union friendly incoming administration, it's going to shower more tens, scores, and hundreds of billions of dollars in the direction. There's something to having that much power, political power. You are going to actually ruin the thing that you're protecting. And there's lessons there, and there's implications there that are going to affect the way that cities are formed. It's going to be very profound in ways that I think most people have not yet begun to grapple with. You're beginning to see glimmers of belated recognition among teachers unions themselves, beginning in late November when, you know, the Randy Weingartens of the world from the American Federation of Teachers are like, oh, we should open schools because there was such a public backlash against them.
We just need more time to have that conversation because, you know, yeah. September showed up and we, you know, we weren't really planning for it.
It's amazing.
I think you're really accurate, although I do want to hold out hope, Matt, that after decades of blaming parents and teachers and administrators and government officials for, you know, flat test scores, it really is time to blame students. And I think it's, you know, students are the problem now, too. If we didn't have students, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Teachers unions have had pivoted to blaming parents about 10, 15 years ago. Like, yeah. Seriously, there was this, like, there was this moment when they were like, listen, I don't know what we're supposed to do here. These kids are coming to us and they're kind of garbage and they were raised by bad people. And I don't think there's not much we can do.
Their parents aren't doing their art projects anymore, you know?
Their parents aren't doing their art projects for them anymore, yeah.
Go ahead.
I was actually just going to say a little subset of Matt's takeaway is also, I hope that we collectively emerge from 2020 with like a moment to reset expectations for kids in schools. Like, school is going to break up a little bit. There's going to be some experimentation and people are going to be doing new things. And a lot of people aren't going to return to the conventional system. Also, all of these elaborately built mechanisms around metrics, which were a good idea at the time. You know, it was better than just like seniority and call it a day. But there's now sort of, I think, an overemphasis on, you know, exactly how to calculate how many points of learning each kid got in each area each year. Those numbers are going to be whacked. Like, those numbers are not going to make any sense anymore. And it's such a great opportunity to blow up some of the, like, make workiness of education bureaucracy, including parents doing freaking science projects. Like, let's just start over on that.
You know, the other to go to
oddly specific there, Catherine.
It's really the art projects.
No,
that
my
were
kids
the
actually
real...
aren't old enough yet. Yeah. I have not gotten into the darkness of parents do science projects because my kids are still kind of below that.
when parents start doing CRISPR technology for their kids' science projects, you know that
I'm just going to get Ron Bailey to do it. I'm going to be like, Ron, Alexa has a science project due. Get over here.
If only we had changed your genes in utero. I think to touch back on a point that I was trying to kind of stumble through earlier, this is where I think a version of public policy nihilism, and there is definitely a libertarian strain of this, needs to be confronted and batted to the side of, you know, kids are going to go to school. There is going to be public dollars for kids to go to school. I can make an argument from a libertarian perspective that that is a good use of tax money to, you know, give kids who otherwise wouldn't have an opportunity to participate fully in life, give them education. But what we need to do is to acknowledge that, you know, governments tend to suck. They tend to be incompetent and inefficient, but there are better and worse policies. And we are at the threshold now, I think, of, you know, when it comes to education, K-12 education, and I think this will have an analogous effect eventually on college as well. We can structure how we pay for or how we account for schools and the provisioning of education using public dollars. And, you know, this is people like Lisa Snell, who used to be at Reason Foundation, Corey DeAngelis, and Aaron Houston, who are at Reason now. You know, there is backpack funding available. There are ways to, you know, come up with a decentralized, you know, personal responsibility laden and accountable system of public funding. And we need to be, if 2021 is going to be a great reset, we have a lot of great policy ideas that are specifically and explicitly libertarian. And we need to fight against the nihilism of like, well, what do you expect? Andrew Cuomo, Bill de Blasio, Donald Trump, Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, Anthony Fauci. Of course, they're going to suck balls. You know, that's what they do. That is their main job. But we can do better.
Can we have like one more second?
I just hope that if there's a backpack funding bill, it's sponsored by JanSport.
Yes. No, L.L. Bean forever, man. I want to take one more second for nihilism because I actually like this is my greatest like temptation is to public policy nihilism. Like this is the thing that I fight every day. Like existentialism, who's her? Don't know her. Fine. No troubles. But like there is no God. We're fine. But the thing that I really struggle with, and like maybe you can help me, Nick, since you've just made such a passionate plea against it, is okay. I'm good on the small stuff. Let's privatize the trash collection. Let's fix the regulation for medical devices. Like all that kind of stuff. I see the way forward. You make the argument. Sometimes it happens. Sometimes it doesn't. But like it's a reasonable project. And then there's the really really big stuff, like you know. Should we pack the courts? No, like fight right. Packing the courts.
Sure.
That like the deep structural stuff, like those fights seem worth having. They're intellectual fights. They happen at the intellectual level. They are rare occurrences when a deep structural change is potentially going to, you know, abolish the Electoral College, stuff like that. So you can kind of have those fights. What do you do about the nihilism of the big, dumb middle? Because that's my problem. It's like, healthcare policy, sorry, Peter, is just, it's a...
I'm sorry, too.
We're all sorry. It's super broken. It basically can't be fixed. There is no way forward. What, like, nihilism is the appropriate response, isn't it?
Well, you know, we have policy, right? And what, you know, and unfortunately, this is where, you know, in certain ways, things are going to be incremental. You know, Peter has written a lot about this. You know, you get like one healthcare reform, a major healthcare reform about every 20, 25 years. And, you know, and you spend 5 to 10 years creating it and then 5 to 10 years, you know, running away from it and setting up the next big equally bad or bad in a different way kind of reform. I think this is where You know, for me, a big part over the past, you know, actually since the Bush administration is like, first off, we need to get to a place where we're telling people, if you can afford to pay for housing, education, and retirement and healthcare, you know, you should do it. We're a rich country. And, you know, what the biggest problem, I think, is that nobody talks anymore. Even this $600, $200 check, it's going out to households that have, you know, adjusted gross incomes of $150,000 with two income earners. Plus, you get more money for kids. If you're making $150,000 in America, or, you know, $100,000, $125,000, you're making, you know, almost twice as much as the median income, you know, household income, like you shouldn't be getting free money from the government. I should not be getting Social Security. We should not be taxing people for Social Security. I should be paying for my kids' college and for their K-12 education out of pocket if I can. And I think that's the beginning of it. And with something like, you know, with entitlements, I think we need to get rid of the idea that people get them because they turn 65. And it's like they're there as a safety net to help people, you know, maintain a certain basic standard of living regardless of age. It's based on need. I think with healthcare, anything that introduces market forces into healthcare is a good first step. And although it's, you know, it's a real minefield because we think we're doing certain things and we don't. You know, weirdly, you know, Bush's prescription Part D, the Medicare prescription D, helped, you know, introduce market forces by expanding the use of high deductible, you know, HSA influenced policy in a way that nobody, I think, really predicted at the time. So, I don't know.
Catherine, before I let Peter go on for a while, probably, one way of looking at it is search for the one big, like, fundamental switch, like in public schools, that is actually backpack funding. It's like fund students, not systems, as Corey DeAngelis tweets 75,000 times a day. Do that. And then everything else looks different. In healthcare, I would say change in the tax code that began in or in the aftermath of World War II, which basically everyone acknowledges is the root cause of the problem. Change that and then see what happens. All right, Peter, you go.
I think that's right, but it's also, I would also just sort of say almost exactly the opposite, just in terms of day-to-day theory, which is look for marginal improvements. So the Trump administration has done a lot of dumb things when it comes to healthcare and sort of thinking about healthcare policy, but they've actually done some stuff that is relatively smart, in particular, the extension of short-term limited duration insurance plans, which created a market for less regulated, less expensive plans, a market that the Obama administration and sort of the liberal Democratic establishment thinks is a bad one that shouldn't exist because it is, quote, junk insurance. It is certainly true that that insurance provides fewer benefits than Obamacare standard plans. But the people buying it, these plans know that. They're paying less for it as a result. And so what it has done is create a market in which hundreds of thousands of people now have taken an option to buy less expensive insurance. The other thing you can do is not just look for marginal improvements, but look for good models. And so this is one of the reasons why we're constantly talking about things like the Oklahoma City Surgery Center, which is basically a no insurance operation that operates on much more market principles. There's limits to that. They can't do every single type of healthcare service that you might want there. On the other hand, in the space that they're working in, they're doing really good and interesting work in providing a model and showing the way. And so if you're sort of, to me, when I struggle, I write about healthcare. It is a giant problem that we are not going to fix next week or next year or the year after that. And so in some ways, you look and you think, oh, my goodness, this is unsolvable. And in some ways, the big problem, it's probably not going to be solved, but you can solve little problems. And in solving little problems, you get closer to solving the big problem, or at least making the big problem somewhat less bad.
All right. We have a waning amount of time here. So let's do a lightning round of predictions for 2021, starting with rolls the dice. Let's go with Catherine Mangu Ward first.
My prediction for 2021 is that everyone is going to be surprised at how it's still bad. Like, it's still going to be bad. And it's not going to be even just still bad in that way of, like, we are finishing up resolving COVID. It's also going to be bad because Joe Biden's going to be president and he's going to be bad. And it's going to be bad because people are going to act out in weird and unpredictable ways as they return to both normal life and normal politics. They are going to do dumb stuff because they forgot how to do normal, sane stuff. That is going to include social behaviors. It is going to include lots of like divorces and rehabs and all kinds of things like that. It's going to include bad policymaking. It's not going to be a great year. I don't want to see people out here tweeting and TikToking like 2021 is going to be my year. It's going to be like at best an okay year. 2022 is going to be the bomb.
Nick, you're on. Yeah. You're flying on drugs. Well, so.
Yeah. I'm just holding out for Cuties 2 on Netflix, Matt.
Yeah.
That'll be the difference maker in 2021. I think what we're going to see, my prediction for 2021 is that we're going to see a return to the ills of bureaucracy as a major irritant in everyday life. Every aspect of our lives is becoming more and more regulated. The COVID, the pandemic and lockdown accelerated a lot of positive trends to decentralize power, demographics, knowledge, expertise, all sorts of things that we've talked about here for months. But it's also created a world in which every aspect of our individual lives and our economic lives and our political lives are more and more regulated than ever. Corporations, places like Google and Facebook and Twitter and Amazon, which grew up as anti-corporations compared to the behemoths of mid-century America, mid-20th century America, AT&T, GM, IBM. They are becoming more and more bureaucratic, and everything is about regulating individual behavior one way or the other, and that leads to bureaucracy, and it's going to be a hellish nightmare dealing with that.
That's a really nice vision that both of you have laid out. I am going to add my dystopia there. My prediction is that there is going to be a tangible political backlash that is based on rising crime rates in cities, which is happening pretty significantly in a lot of different places. Not only the rising crime, but also the kind of unwillingness by people in the media, among certain activists, and sadly, even some criminal justice reformers with whom I 98% of the time agree with. Unwillingness to just acknowledge that and to sort of talk away the round of it. There's been a spike in crime. Who knows why? I mean, there's a lot of different theories. But like, if people continue to pretend that there isn't one, and perhaps even if they do, but or they don't, I don't know where I am, there's going to be a political backlash. And I worry about that. Some of that might be a good political backlash in the way that it unseats, several generations long, lousy, corrupt democratic establishments in cities like Chicago, New York. But some of it will also be bad in terms of people will try to grind long overdue criminal justice reform measures to a halt, blaming them for whatever happens. And I worry about that on a daily basis. Peter, what is your prediction for 2021? Make it happy.
Movie theaters will reopen in limited capacity, but be a comparatively niche product. People are going to watch Dune and The Matrix 4, both of which are coming out next year.
And will suck.
And they're going to watch they're going to watch those movies on their phones. Because they can. Oh. And because the theatrical experience is objectively better in basically every way, it's just a lot less convenient, a lot less accessible, a lot more expensive, both in terms of time and dollars. And so the movie theater experience.
So not better in those ways.
Yes. Those aren't the ways that matter for the movie. They're the ways that matter for your convenience.
Movie.
And so, I mean, I think the movie theater experience is going to end up looking a lot like the pizza experience. And so for a lot of people, Red Baron, and notice I did not say DiGiorno, Red Baron pizza, the frozen stuff that you get in the grocery store aisle, is in some sense the best pizza. Not because it's actually better pizza, but because it is there. It's cheap. It's convenient. It does not even require you to pull up an app. It takes 18 minutes in the oven. You can even put it in the microwave sometimes. Don't really recommend that. You don't have to go anywhere. It's just there in your freezer. The Red Baron pizza of movies, of movie watching, is going to become not the default for everyone, but a very common choice that works for a lot of people a lot of the time. And like movie people, in some ways like me, are going to have a lot of Sturm und Drang about this. But this is just the reality that we're looking at. And as a result, sort of the opposite of that is that while many people gravitate towards Red Baron, there will be a counter movement towards really high quality corner store pizza, which is to say that Alamo Drafthouse will not become the kind of the AMC of the future. But what it will become is the, I don't know, the Pete's Pizzeria, whatever, two Amy's.
Comet Pizza.
Right.
Go there,
not the Comet.
And ping
but
pong. It's,
but there will be a move towards really high quality fancy pizza for the people who really care. And the theatrical experience when people have it will become more luxurious and better.
I love that vision, Peter. And I'll add one thing that actually economic pressures will keep those places will become better theaters, and they're already out there, but they're going to have to keep their prices down because it's too much of it will be too small a niche otherwise, I think. And the other thing I want to say as we close out this year, watch The Irishman on your cell phone. It is a better movie than watching it on a big screen and seeing how fake the de-aging process was, and also the plot
wow.
holes. The plot holes are smaller on a phone.
I think the year in review of 2020 for this podcast is Nick trying to fight Peter four different episodes about The Irishman.
Do you guys remember that we spent all of December in 2019? We should have been talking about the pandemic, and instead we spent the whole month fighting about The Irishman.
By the way, can't even remember it. Peter, you might know this. There's a movie where Robert De Niro plays like a Southern guy who's a woodsman, and he runs into John Travolta, who plays a Russian guy with like a shaved head and a weird beard and mustache.
Nick, Matt told you not to talk about psychedelics right now.
Okay. Well, now I'm pretty sure.
I think this is your Shaq Genie movie.
He's killing baby L. Ron Hubbard in the woods.
Yeah. It was a very confusing where you have two of the most Italian. I mean, the only one not only Italian. Italian-American not in that movie is Anthony Fauci.
Let's go to what you've been consuming, my God. I will go first so as to preempt anyone else from taking the movie Soul, which a lot of people seem to have watched, based on my Twitter feed at least. And
did you watch it on your phone?
Hell no. I watched
Red Baron pizza style.
Did you watch it on your kid's Kindle Fire?
I watch it on the biggest screen available to me, which is 10 feet away from where I'm sitting. We had it on Family Movie Night, which is a very interesting way to see it, largely because of the different reactions to it and interpretations days later. For those who don't know about it, it's a Pixar animation directed or co-directed by Pete Docter. We can call him a doctor because that's his name, who is the same guy who did Inside Out. It's very much in the spirit or sort of similarity to Inside Out, except I liked it a lot better. About a jazz musician slash music teacher, or actually should be the other way around, music teacher slash jazz musician, who finally gets the one big great gig. I'm not spoiling anything here. And then steps in a manhole and goes to the great beyond, but then tries to fight like hell to go back because he's got to do his one big great gig. Along the way, he goes to this place, sort of like the great before, I think it's called, where there's little babies that have to
souls,
learn
Matt,
things.
Souls.
Souls.
Pre-bortions,
to become babies.
We call them on the street.
And
Hitler was there.
He meets a little bouncing Tina Fey person and hijinks ensue. Anyways, the animation, especially surrounding the performance of jazz, is pretty incredible. And like everyone, it's unlike a whole lot of animated movies I've seen over the past few years. Like you end up talking about it the next day and the day after, and there's different sharply different takeaways. My 12-year-old, interestingly, had the takeaway that the moral of the story is that your life becomes more enriching when you finally tell your mom that she's full of crap. and then you stand up for yourself in the face of her inaccurate disses. And her mother had a kind of opposite reaction to it, which is interesting, and the 5-year-old, too. I have a pretty dark take on it that I won't get into. But
why not, Matt Welch? This is your moment. Please.
Because I, unlike everybody else on this podcast who is not a lady look at the clock while we're doing this.
You're already in your basement.
Nick Gillespie. Okay. There's a darkness about music in there that's pretty interesting.
The pizza is preheating for your Red Baron pizza, right?
Speaking of French goodbyes, Nick, tell us how great the long Wonder Woman movie
I want to just ask very quickly, Matt, what kind of jazz is in Seoul? I haven't watched it because my Disney Plus, my free subscription ended on December 9th, and there's no way in hell that I'm going to pay like $10 a month, you know, to watch Seoul. But is it like ski-doo-bop-a-doo, or is it like...
It's just classic.
Is it Miles Davis?
It's classic. It's classic four piece.
We're gonna need a little bit more from Nick so we can be sure what we're talking about. What kind of jazz is that?
It's just classic four piece jazz. Nick, piano, guitar, sax.
What's
drums.
He play? Is he a trumpet? Is he a horn man?
He's a piano player.
A dime a dozen.
He's tinkling the ivories, Catherine.
He's tinkling the ivories, Matt.
He's not.
Yeah, so speaking of movies that I watched on a TV screen, I watched Wonder Woman 84, and it was a really crappy movie, and it reminds me, this is where I'm starting to come around to Martin Scorsese's vision, his negative vision of superhero movies. It is a tired, terrible thing that... is pretty good when they're playing Quidditch on Paradise Island, where it's just the ladies. That's kind of fun. And then when it shifts to, you know, Washington, D.C. in 1984, it just becomes a sodden, soggy mess of like kind of camp, but not really. And just a real... A real uninteresting thing, and I wish I had something better to recommend.
You didn't love how they dressed up Georgetown in 1980 style?
It was impressive.
They brought back Commander Salamander
I was watching that with my girlfriend, and I said, oh, you know, the Commander Salamander, and, you know, so it was nice that they had that level of detail, but it would have been nice if they had spent more time on the plot and or the character development or something. And it's a reminder that movies, like food, is mostly disappointing.
Peter?
I didn't love Wonder Woman 1984, but I did love the novel I've been reading, Love and Other Thought Experiments by Sophie Ward. It's, I think, maybe the quickest way to describe it is as a book that is almost supernaturally well targeted at Catherine Mengu Ward.
No relation to Sophie.
I actually had to text her over the weekend just to tell her exactly how well targeted it was, because this is a novel that's made up of a series of linked short stories that kind of connect and sort of tell a larger story. It's a book that takes old philosophy problems, then converts them into a series of linked novelistic short stories about consciousness and relationships, starts as kind of upper middle class literary fiction, delves into complex parenting issues, then becomes a story of solar exploration, a kind of science fiction story about altered consciousness and AI. And it is written by the actress who played the love interest in the 1980s Young Sherlock Holmes movie, who just happens to have a doctorate in philosophy and literature that is focused on the use of narrative in philosophy. It's less than 250 pages. It's a great length. It's incredibly moving and kind of smart, and also like just like a super engaging read that you can get through in an evening. Highly recommended.
Wow.
Catherine, I just want to, back in the golden era of porn in theaters, I remember seeing a movie that was titled Hung Sherlock Holmes when Young Sherlock Holmes came out.
Was it played by John is the question?
No, I don't think so.
I will say I did immediately purchase this book after Peter texted me. I have not read it yet. I will now be going to search out also the Hung Sherlock Holmes film just to round out the corpus. Obviously, I wish you hadn't saved me for...
Didn't Pornhub purge everything recently?
I wish you hadn't saved me for last, because my recommendation is the weakest sauce of anything I have brought in 2020. But I do feel like it matches up with the rest of our conversation, so I'm going to go with it, which is that I... on like the day before, maybe like the day before Christmas Eve, just sat and looked on my phone and watched the previews for all of the bad Christmas, like Hallmarky movies back to back, because I had been listening to Mary Catherine Ham's Christmas Influencer podcast, which is called A Christmas Ham. And it's she's been reviewing all the bad Hallmark rom-com Christmas movies, which there are now like 25 of them. Like, you watch them like an advent calendar. They're all the same formula with slightly different tweaks. And they're like, a fancy city lady goes back to hometown and falls in love with wood chopper who turns out to be a millionaire. But like, just...
Wait, is that the Robert De Niro movie?
It's the one Nick was trying to think of. But I watched them. I just sat and watched them on my phone as per our new Red Baron media consumption arrangements. And I certainly would never watch any of these movies. I would never. I know y'all know that I have somewhat low standards for rom-coms, but this is below them. But I really enjoyed just like getting these like high serotonin bursts like directly into my brain, you know, rapid fire. So that is what I recommend. Like, watch more trailers. Movie trailers are good. For if you're not going to go see movies, which I am not, and which you are not because it's 2020, just like watch a ton of movie trailers. You really get, it's like almost an 80-20 in the case of bad movies. Like, you're really getting 80% of the value. But the other thing I did, and I want to thank our podcast listeners, is I have made some progress on my Moby Dick problems. My Moby Dick reading is moving along. And in particular,
would you say that Moby Dick is your Moby
it
Dick?
Is. No, I'm
like
gonna.
It's the white whale of your
call
novel.
Call me Ishmael. I am going to particularly thank someone who suggested that I go back and read all of the quotes about whales at the beginning, which I had skipped because they cried out to be skipped. But that was the wrong thing to do. And I now know a lot of cool things about whales from the history of literature. So Moby Dick, you guys, it might be okay. I will keep us posted, though hopefully not too often on this podcast, as I try to proceed in that reading.
Amen. So thank you everyone for listening. Have wrestle the year to a close, do your best, and continue listening to all of our podcast offerings, which you can find at reason.com/podcasts. These include, but are not limited to, the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie on Wednesdays and the Soho Forum debates, which tend to come out on Fridays. And also, please email us your queries, your questions that you would like us to address and read on air. And you can even be fancy and record an audio too, although we probably wouldn't use it. Roundtable@reason.com is where they live. And if you start sending them now, we'll start reading them next week in the new year. It's our New Year's resolution, more answered questions from all y'all. That's it. Have fun. Good night.